Magyanatimirandasyagyanam jana shalakaya chakshudun militam yena tashmi shri gurave nama vancha kalpataru vyascha kripa sindubhya evacha titanam pavane pivashna vibhyanamo nama narapita charim chirat karunayavatirna kalahu Shamar Paitamunatosh Palarasam Subhakti Shriam Hari Purata Sundara Duty Kadamba Sundi Pita Sadari Dae Kandare Shurato Vasachinandana Janulambita Bajo Kanakaba Dato Sankirtanae Kapitaro Kamalaya Takshu Vishwamburu Duyabaru Jugadharma Palu Unde Jagat Priyakaro Karuna Avataru He Krishna Karuna Sindhu Dinavandho Jagat Pate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostate Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrindavaneshwari Vrishabhanu Suti Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Bhaktya bhinaya paradha lakshay chitta shakamaditaranmadi kripa maitvam sharanam tapanam vrinde namaste charanaravindam vrinde namaste charanaravindam Sri Sachinandan Gaur Hari ki jai, Sri Hari Nam Sankirtan ki jai, Sri Sri Guru Parampara ki jai, Sri Sri Radha Gopinath Jagannath Balaji Subhadra Gaur Nityananda ki jai, Sri Mati Lila Nandini ki jai, Sadhu Sangha ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari So, welcome to all of you, Nandavan. Thank you so much for your presence. And we are continuing today on trying to explore together some themes connected to what we have been sharing so far, which in my at least experience estimation are crucial aspects of what it means to be a devotee, what it means to be part of Krishna consciousness, and how to understand our bhakti journey, bhakti project, in a way that is as relevant, as relatable, as realistic as possible. Right. So we can continue choosing to be devotees always for the right reasons. We don't want people leaving the movement, and we don't want people staying in the movement for the wrong reasons. So on a daily basis, we are invited to decide from which place do we want to participate, to contribute, to make our loving, voluntary offering of service for the pleasure of Krishna, Guru, Gauranga. So that entails hopefully getting together and discussing topics that are important for all of us. So today we will talk about one of those, in my opinion, hopefully in your opinion as well. Let's see at the end of the gathering how relevant of a topic this is. And I'd like to talk today on the topic of non-duality or non-dual thinking. And in connection to that, about interconnectedness and separateness. So don't be scared. It won't be that abstract as it may sound to some. I'll try to keep it as relatable as possible. We have been talking so far about what radical personalism means, and vulnerability, empowerment, human condition. On the day of Mahaprabhu Sannyas, we talk about also redeeming our relationship with matter. So today I thought, yeah, we can talk about non-dualism or non-duality or non-dual thinking. So when I speak about non-dualism, again, I try to clarify very quickly, we are not talking about some form of impersonalism, although for many of us, non-duality or non-dualism may sound like some form of merging and everything is one and so on. That's why in the 10th chapter of Radical Personalism, I titled the chapter Non-Dual Thinking. Everything is one, but never impersonal. So if things are not impersonal, in which sense they are one? How is there is possible to have some sense of unity with diversity at the same time? So, of course, there are traditions who are non-dual to the core, let's put it that way, and we call them radical non-dualism, like Advaita Vedanta, like Shankaracharya's proposal is everything is one to the core, which means there's nobody else, only Brahman, right? That's their proposal. At the end of the day, everything is an illusion. This world does not exist. You do not exist, with all respect. Your ideas about relationships are all phantasmagoria. Even the idea of God is unreal. There's only one thing, Brahman. And you just have to awaken to the fact that you and everything is that. So we call that radical non-dualism. To the extreme and to the root, there's non-duality. There's nothing else apart from that one thing. So our tradition is non-dual, but not radical non-dualism. I call our tradition radical personalism, but that includes a form of non-dualism, a form of non-duality. So we'll be explaining in a minute what we mean by that. And sorry if it sounds that I'm using some new words and all this stuff, but as we were talking these days also, sometimes it's important to invoke or to speak about some topics with some words, and that words will create a new framework, and that new framework will create a new experience. And many times we need new experiences in Christian consciousness, and one of the ways we can create that is being creative in invoking frameworks or works that serve to convey the experience in the best possible way. So our tradition, Vaishnavism, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Bhakti, however you may like to call it, is a non-dual tradition. It's not a non-dual tradition. It's a non-dual tradition. And just to share an immediate reference from the scriptures, and I will briefly explain what do I mean by non-dual. Allow me to keep some suspense and mystery for a few seconds. In the very beginning of the Srimad Bhagavatam, first canto, second chapter, 11th verse, Sukadeva is saying, Badanti tattattva vidas tattvam jnanam advayam brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaneti shabdyate. So, one of the top 10 verses or something. It's in the top 108 for sure. But it's there. It's one of the main verses. But many sometimes devotees we remember more the last part. Brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavaneti shabdyate. Yeah, Brahman paramatma bhagavan. Yeah, of course. But what's first? That's the diversity part of the verse. Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan. But first, you have to get the unity part. So, Badanti Tattva Vidas, the knowers of truth, the Tattva Vids, Tattvam Yat Jnanam Advayam. They describe reality as non-dual consciousness. That's a very interesting line. Advaya Jnan Tattva. In Sanskrit, Tattva means many things. One of them means it's reality. The ultimate reality is Advaita Gyan. Gyan here means consciousness. And Advaita means non-dual. Dvaita means dual, duality. Advaita, like Advaita, means non-dual. So, and then it says this non-dual reality is known as Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan. But first it's non-dual. There is non-duality at the foundation. So Bhagavatam says reality is non-dual consciousness. It's an interesting way. It may sound still abstract, and we'll try to unpack now, but that's an interesting way to put it. Like, what's reality? Reality is non-dual consciousness. Srila Jiva Goswami takes upon that verse, and he considers how to unpack this verse, and he writes something called Shat Sandarbha, which is a monumental treatise, six-part treatise, which is basically an explanation of that verse. What this verse of the Bhagavatam means, what's reality? Everyone is asking that somehow, indirectly or directly. So this verse is defining God as reality, and that reality being non-dual consciousness. The ultimate reality is non-dual consciousness. So reality has these two aspects. The ultimate reality is conscious and it's non-dual. Advaita means non-dual. Interestingly, Advaita includes the word Dvaya. Dvaya means dual. So non-duality includes duality. Duality is part of reality, so to say. But duality is not a separate existence. It's not like there's non-duality and there's duality having its own orbit. No, that doesn't happen. Everything is integrated in one single reality. Let's put it this way. I will try to use as many words as I can to make the point in some way or another. Self-existent reality is only one. And therefore it's non-dual. There are no two realities. Srila Prabhupada sometimes will speak about God as one without a second. No, there are not two. There's only one. And everything that exists is in connection to that one. There's nothing existing isolated, separated, unplugged ontologically from that one. In that sense, reality is non-dual. There are not two ultimate realities, so to say. But of course, to say that doesn't mean that there are no individual beings. Again, when we say reality is non-dual, doesn't mean that everything is Brahman. It doesn't mean that nothing exists apart of some homogeneous substance that we are all ultimately merging in, or we are all that. No, that some people think like that. Again, non-duality means just there's one thing and now we think there is something else. No, no. There's diversity, individuals, but all that diversity is founded, sustained on non-duality, on unity, on the interconnectedness of everything. Let's put it this way. Krishna is the center of gravity, and whatever exists is gravitating towards that center, or revolving around that center. Everything is orbiting around ultimate reality. Nothing has its own separate orbit, its own separate reality or center. He is the center. So that something is non-dual, apart from what I've tried to say so far, means that something is self-existent and self-contained. And its reality is, in the words of Hegel, he will say, Srila Siddhar Maharaj will quote this from Hegel, reality is for itself and by itself and for itself. So it says there is no like other purpose outside of it. In that sense, it's self-contained. It is grounded in itself. It does not depend on any external support. Again, I'm trying to say to make the point from in one way. And nothing can exist independent of that non-dual reality. No. There's nothing that exists independent of that, disconnected from that, orbiting in its own axis, separate, so to say. And because of this, again, some of our acharyas may have said, it is one without the second. There's no two, there's only one. Can I ask you the book, that one on top? Yeah. I'd like to share briefly one quote with which I start the chapter by Srila Prabhupada. It's a quote from one Bhagavatam purport that he shares, if I'm not mistaken. Let me see. yeah, he says, in the Vedas it is said that only the Lord alone exists and all others' existences depend on him. He is the generating reservoir for everyone's existential capacity. He is the supreme truth of all other categorical truths. So that's Srila Prabhupada's way of mentioning, making this point, right? But again, this verse from the Bhagavatam, Badanti Tattatpavida, says, okay, reality is non-dual, reality is whole in itself, is self-contained. As one Christian friend will tell, reality is unbroken wholeness. That's an interesting way of putting it. It's self-contained, it's complete in itself. But it expresses itself in different ways. In this verse it says Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan. but on the basis of non-duality. In other words, Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan, they are not three different people or three different entities, which we will go in a minute there, because sometimes I've seen devotees not being grounded enough in non-duality, and they will speak of Krishna and Paramatma as two different gods or something like that. No, Paramatma is over here, Krishna is over there, who knows where, or in the altar, or in this, he's hyper-localized in certain places, but not everyone else. And Paramatma is another guy, something like that. And we create this like dualism instead of understanding in a non-dual way, they are one. They are different expressions of the same ultimate reality. They are one and they are different. Of course, that's our philosophy, bhed abhed. So we need to be okay with this nuance perpetually. Every time we make a point, it's one, we have to be flexible enough to quickly say, but also there is some difference. And when we speak about diversity, we should be also quick enough to point to the underlying common foundation. So we have to navigate this tension in a very creative way. So Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan, again, they are not three different entities. They are the same entity, the same non-dual substance, perceived in different degrees. And sometimes I like to give the example of, how do you say in English, the subway, the metro? I don't know. Subway, you say in English? Yeah. So if you are waiting for the subway in the tunnel, and you're looking to the tunnel if the subway is coming, and the first thing you will see when it's coming is a light in the distance, front light of the subway. That will be something like Brahman. At the distance, it's all light, right? Eventually, the subway comes closer and you realize, oh, no, there is an actual subway. There's not only light, there is a wagon and so on. So that will be something more specified. Let's compare that to Paramatman. And then eventually the subway stops and opens and there's people inside. And you enter and you start to interact with people. There's a more personalized dynamics. So that will be more akin to Bhagavan. When it's there is the most personalized possibility of interaction. But it's the same thing. The light, the wagon, the people inside in one sense are all what we call subway, the subway experience, so to say. So in the same way, Brahman, Paramatma, Bhagavan are, Jiva Goswami mentions in Bhagavad Sandarbha, are degrees of perception of the same non-dual reality. So, for example, Brahman is the unqualified expression of the Absolute, and Bhagavan is the hyper qualified expression of the Absolute, but both are the Absolute. So although sometimes we are not so much fond of, so to say, Brahman, still we have to be careful not to totally dismiss that, because that's a possibility. That's an aspect of the Absolute. So we have to be very careful not to be, how to say, insulting the light in the subway, right? The subway without light can be dangerous. You can have an accident. So there is some purpose to the light. No? So there it's mentioned about, and it's mentioned in scriptures. It's acknowledged. It's an aspect of the, it's an integrated part of this non-dual substance. So it may not be our cup of tea, as they say, but it doesn't mean we need to stigmatize it or anything. So the Bhagavatam begins with this verse almost. It's coming just at the beginning. Reality is non-dual consciousness. It expresses itself in this diversity. So it brings these two points. First, unity. Reality is one, non-dual, and is diverse. God is diverse, Brahman, Paramatman, Bhagavan, and so on. And then, of course, all the Shaktis of God are present there. Jivas, Maya Shakti, Swarup Shakti. And each one have their own uniqueness as well. But the foundation is, again, non-dual. Everything exists interrelated, interconnected. And interestingly, then at the very end of the Bhagavatam, 12th canto, just a quantum leap to the last part, 13th chapter, which is the last chapter of the last canto of the Bhagavatam, verse 12, almost the last verse of the Bhagavatam, then the Bhagavatam again invokes the word Vastu Advitiyam. So Advaitiya means again Advai, Advaita, non-dual. And it says Tat Nishtam, which means the prime subject is kind of making a summary of the whole book, the last verses. And it says the prime subject matter of this book has been Vastu Advaitiyam, this non-dual substance. So there is a place to say the main topic of the Bhagavatam is non-dual reality. Again, understood in our particular, of course, different schools will understand that in different ways. And that's why you can even find, I don't know, followers of Shankaracharya giving Bhagavat Saptaha and class on the Bhagavatam and explain the whole Bhagavatam from their understanding of non-dual reality. And members from the Ramanuja Sampradaya explaining it from their perspective and so on. We have our own particular take. And we will say, yes, we can make a case. The whole Srimad Bhagavatam is about non-duality. It says there in that verse that I'm mentioning. And our whole tradition revolves around the Srimad Bhagavatam, right? I mean, it's the main text. So Gaudiya Vaishnavism revolves around Srimad Bhagavatam, and Srimad Bhagavatam revolves around non-duality. So our whole tradition revolves around non-duality. Understood in a certain way, as we are explaining and continue to explain. But I'm just making that point because for many of us, non-duality is not an issue at all. It doesn't appear in our language. We don't even think about that. Or we may even think that's part of other tradition. No, and we have to reject that. But actually, it's basically what we are all about, whether we know it or not, or whether we call it in one way or another. So the non-duality or non-dualism of our tradition is not, of course, the radical non-dualism of Advaita Vedanta. Everything is Brahman. That's not our non-dualism. Ours is, let's call it, a nuanced non-dualism. That there is, everything is one in the sense of it's God and all his potencies, as Prabhupada will say, and everything is connected to him. But on the basis of that foundation of interconnectedness and unity, there is diversity. There can be diversity in a way that it doesn't conflict. But that's what allows for proper interaction. I remember once Bhakti Rasa told me that. And I appreciated that insight. I included that in the book, but I didn't give credit to her. So I'm doing that publicly now. Sorry for the plagiarism. Plagiarism.
It's okay.
No, yeah, it's okay. Everything is one. All authors are one. So which was the point? The point was, okay, we are having relationships, and relationships allow for the experience of connection. But actually, if we wouldn't have a common non-dual foundation, if we wouldn't be sharing a common center, we couldn't relate at all because we wouldn't have anything in common, anything substantial in common. So actually the very fact that first of all comes this non-dual foundation that connects us all with a common center is what allows for the possibility of relationship and proper connection on the basis of that common center, common foundation. So that's basically our school of thought, Gaudiya Vaishnavism, Achintya Bhed Abhed. No? From the Abheda side, and Abheda means non-different. From the Abheda side, we could say everything is one. And I know it starts to feel like, well, it's too, but that's the Abheda side of the equation. Everything is Krishna. I mean, there's a place to say that. But then, of course, from the Bheda side, from the different side, yeah, everything in Krishna, in which sense? That nothing exists disconnected from him. Nothing exists independent from him. In that sense, there is difference. And we have individuality. But at the same time, we are not entirely different from Krishna. We are not entirely the same. We are not entirely different. We are not entirely the same from one another. I'm not you. You are not me. But we are not entirely different to the point that we have absolutely nothing in common, no? Which is what many people think. No? In some cases, I have nothing in common with that person. That whole group, that whole race, that whole religion should disappear from the planet Earth. That's a point that sometimes we create that thick wall when there's absolute separateness. which is one of the topics today, interconnectedness versus separateness. We can really feel each other so separate to the point that there's nothing that we share in common at all. And when we reach that point, be prepared for the worst terrible abominations of human history, when you can just exterminate millions of people because there's absolutely nothing in common between us. So that's so dangerous to lose sight of what connects us. And again, this idea of non-duality has to do with we all share a common foundation because reality is non-dual consciousness, which means everything exists integrated, interconnected. So this is our philosophy, Veda Ved. It's a very interesting concept. And every philosophy, I will argue, of different Vaishnavas and Pradayas present their version of Veda Ved, present their version of Dvaita Advaita, for example. In Bhark Sampradaya, Vishishta Dvaita from Anujacharya. He will say, Advaita but Vishishta Dvaita, with some specialty and qualification. So everyone, Madhva, even Madhva will say Dvaita, which seems like dualism. But it's more a dualism in terms of opposing the Advaita notion of Sankaracharya. It's not that he's saying there is absolute dualism in every sense. So every Vaishnava philosopher and Sampradaya is trying to make that point of there's unity and there's diversity. There's interconnectedness, but there's also enough separation so each of us can be individuals and can relate to each other. This notion of Veda Ved also sometimes is called, sorry, so many words today, new words, panentheism. I don't know if you heard that word, not pantheism, but panentheism, which means all in God. No, pan means all, en means in, theism, theos, God. So panentheism means God is in everything, everything is in God. Like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 6, verse 30. Yomam pasyati sarvatra asarvam chamai pasyati, and so on. For one who sees me in everything and who sees everything in me, I'm never lost to him, he's never lost to me. That's the panentheistic verse par excellence in the Bhagavad Gita. Because Krishna is saying that someone is seeing me in everything and is seeing everything in me. Doesn't mean that I am everything and everything is me and there is absolutely no difference. But at the same time, there's not absolute disconnection from Krishna and the rest. And that's the vision that the topmost devotee has. When the Bhagavatam describes the three levels of devotee, the three levels of vision, Kanishta sees Krishna were just in the altar. As I like to joke sometimes, if you are too much of a Kanishta, you will only see Krishna in your altar. In my altar, he's more present. When I go to your house, my house, Krishna, there's more Krishna in my altar. That when you are very Kanishta. Not only Krishna is in the altar, it's in my altar. You progress in your Kanishtahood. Okay, Krishna's in every altar. I become more generous. And then you progress more, Madhyam, vision. Okay, Krishna is not only in the altar, it's in the hearts of other living entities. Okay, you needed to be brought back to reality. Brahman is here. The light of the subway is coming. So what's the vision of the Madhyam? Madhyam goes a little bit beyond the altar. He says, oh, Krishna is in every heart. And the Uttam, the highest devotee, he sees what or she sees what? Everything in Krishna, Krishna in everything. That's what the Bhagavatam is saying in the 11th canto. Krishna is in everything, everything is in Krishna. So this panentheism, this is the ultimate idea of Achintya Veda Veda. One and different. Everything is Krishna in the sense that everything is in Krishna. And Krishna is in everything. There is no place where Krishna is not. This as we mentioned, the panentheistic verse par excellence of the Gita, we can go to the panentheistic lila par excellence in the Bhagavatam, which is when Krishna eats dirt. No, we know the famous lila. He's accused by Balaram and his friends that he has eaten dirt. He's reported to Yashoda. Of course, as we know, Yashoda always asks Balaram, "You are Doji, your elder brother. You have to take care of your younger Lala. You have to report me any mischief stuff." I'm hearing reports from all the gopis in Vrindavan, the elder gopis. He's stealing. He said, "You please keep him straight. We don't want him spoiled when he grows. He's supposed to be the heir. He's supposed to be the heir to the throne of Nanda Maharaj, so we don't want spoiled prince here in the cowshed. So keep him straight," and so on. But part of that is Krishna is reported to have eaten dirt. So, and Krishna, of course, he's in denial of that. No? When Yashoda comes, say, open your mouth. He said, "No, open your mouth. I have been reported you have eaten dirt, soil, earth." Says, "No, I haven't eaten earth. All these guys are accusing me falsely. They're envious of me. They're jealous of me because I'm defeating them on a daily basis in wrestling. So they want to humiliate. They're bullying me. No, they want to see me humiliated because they are so jealous that I always defeating them." Which is not true, because Krishna is generally always defeated in wrestling by friends like Sridham or others, no, who are described in Shastra as being more powerful than Krishna, interestingly enough. No, that's what comes when Krishna is, for example, lifting Govardhan. I don't want to go too much out of the narrative, but Krishna is lifting Govardhan, as we know. That's an overtly Aishwaryak Leela. No, Krishna is showing Aishwarya. He's a young boy lifting a hill. That's kind of, imagine if your kid lifts the whole castle here. No, you start to doubt about the ontological position of your son, right? Like, I thought, yeah. stop disturbing the community with that stuff, please. Leave us at peace. Okay, you're getting closer to the Brajavasi consciousness. Because that's what the Brajavasi did. No, he somehow lifted the hill and nobody thought, "What's going on? He must be God. What's this extraordinary exhibition of power?" Yashoda was like, "He must be hungry after all these days." So she's bringing food and trying to feed Krishna directly. His friends are coming. "Hey, Krishna, you must be tired of lifting this hill for so many days. And we all know that you are not as strong as some of us. So give us the hill to us. We will keep it for a while. And you take rest and we give massage to your arm." So that's the psychology of the Brajavasis. Even when Krishna is showing Aishwarya, like overt power in your face, they are not seeing it. They are seeing even that Aishwarya triggers their madhurya, triggers their intimacy and sweetness. No. So that's the psychology of the Brajavasi. No matter what you put in front of them, it only increases their feelings of intimacy to Krishna. So I'm saying this because, again, their friends Sridham will tell Krishna, "I always defeat you in wrestling. So give me the heel. I'm stronger than you. You take some rest." So similarly in this situation, Krishna will say, "They are accusing me of eating dirt because they are jealous of me defeating them in wrestling." Their friends in the distance are like, "We know you always lose with us. That's not true. That's not a valid argument." Anyhow, so Krishna is defeated and just to say, "Open your mouth." And as we know, Krishna opens his mouth. And what happens there is kind of this like kaleidoscopic vision that Yashoda sees Krishna's mouth and inside sees the whole universe inside Krishna, but Krishna inside the universe, and inside the universe is Krishna, inside that Krishna there is the universe and it has no end. It's like a spiral which has no end, and she becomes absolutely bewildered. But what she's seeing in that vision is what we are talking about here. Krishna is in everything and everything is in Krishna, and Krishna is in everything and everything is in Krishna, because Krishna is inside planet Earth, but planet Earth is inside Krishna, and Krishna is inside planet. So at the end of the day, Krishna was kind of chuckling, "Well, mom, you want to see if I had eaten some earth? There is some plenty, some earth here. Let's see." a few planetary systems. Oh, anyhow, Krishna has his sense of humor for sure. But at the end of the day, the point is reality is non-dual. No? Reality is lying on this foundation of unity, of interconnectedness, and all these different expressions of the divine, which are diverse, especially in our tradition, are all founded on this one. We could speak in terms of tattva and rasa. Sometimes it's this expression, tattva vichar, rasa vichar. Vichar means like consideration or discernment. So in tattva, in metaphysical principle, all the forms of Krishna are one, are the same. In rasa, in the relishment and the experience and the taste, there is difference between whatever. Vishnu, Ram, Krishna, there's different taste. But in tattva, they're one. That's what Rupa Goswami says in Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. But again, we have to keep in mind this non-dual foundation. All of them are one to begin with, and on that foundation, they express them differently. Because if not, we have this problem. Paramatma is here, and Krishna is over there, and I create this separateness. Krishna is somewhere else in his pastoral lila, and Paramatma is trapped inside my heart or something like that. And I don't see them as the same person, which they are in one sense. They are not entirely the same. There's different in rasa, but they're not entirely different either. And again, especially in our tradition, we have so many, such a pantheon of expressions of the divine. You have, I don't know, the three Vishnus, Shirodakasai Vishnu, Karanodakasai Vishnu, and so on. You have the Panchatattva, there you have five, then you have the Dasavatar, and there you have 10. You name it. And we have all these categories and subcategories, and you have Krishna. Oh, you say, well, Krishna, but you have Krishna in Mathura, Krishna in Dwarka, Krishna in Vrindavan. Then you have different Krishnas, if you will, in each relationship, so to say. But all of them are one. Follow my point. All the thing, all these manifestations are the same person in one sense. So if we do not emphasize non-duality enough, we can end up being polytheistic, worshiping different gods, worship the same God as if we were different people. And sometimes I tell them to devotees, especially when we, like the other day, we were celebrating in, that was Italy, and we were celebrating Bhagavan Dwadasi, no, some days ago. And I was trying to make the point, don't forget that Bhagavan Dev is Krishna, right? He's not a different person. When we celebrate Narasimha Dev, Narasimha Chaturdasi, whatever, Rama, Navami, Gopurnima, all of them are the same person. But the point is, do you feel like that when we celebrate? Or we feel like, okay, here is Ram, here is Mahaprabhu, here is Kurma Avatar, Matsya, Bhaman, Paras. Are we creating different gods? So that speaks about our lack, without condemning anyone, it happens, okay. That shows that we still do not have an integrated view and realization of non-dual foundation. All of them are one in one sense. In one sense, they are different, but in one sense, they are one. Because if we don't have that in place, again, we became polytheistic. We are worshiping different gods, no? Especially here, be careful. You have three altars here. You have to be careful. Nitai Gaur, Jagannath Baladev, and Nitai are the same person. They don't look similar, but they're the same. So I know it's difficult, and we cannot just force our, but at least in principle, we have to keep that in mind on some level. So our tradition is not polytheistic, although there are many forms. Our tradition could be called more technically polymorphic monotheism.
Right? Julius Lickner, yeah.
Sorry?
There's an Indologist who calls it like that.
Okay. I've heard in a few places. And actually, it's based on one verse of the Bhagavatam, I would say, in chapter 40 of the 10th canto, Akrura's prayers and so on. And he uses the expression Bahumurti Ekamurtikam. So he refers to Krishna, Bahumurti, many forms, ekamurtikam, one form. No? So you have many forms, but you are one form. In other words, you are the same person appearing. So that's another way of saying polymorphic, bimurti, ekamurtikam, monotheism. So again, it's a concept, and gradually we have to internalize the concept and realize the concept. So when we are doing our puja, our prayers, our life and relationship with God, we understand what's actually going on. And we are not kind of like divided into 3,000 deities, so to say. So again, to put it bluntly, Narayan and Krishna Mahaprabhu are not different people, right? They're the same person. So it's important that we kind of integrate this so we can become non-dual, not only in our understanding, but only also in our relationship with everything. Because the opposite of this non-dual understanding is dualism. So what's dualism? Dualism means I'm seeing things separate, divided, disconnected from each other, like fragmented. I'm seeing parts instead of wholes. And this is this famous verse in the Srimad Bhagavatam, 11th canto, which somehow describes the consequences briefly, but describes them of dualism. It says, Bhayam dvitiya abhinibeshata syat, and so on. So it begins saying, Bhayam dvitiya. Dvitiya means the opposite of advitiya or advaya. Dvitiya means duality. So from abhinivesh, from absorption in dualistic thinking, from absorption in seeing things separate from each other instead of interconnected, bhayam, fear comes. Because when I see everything disconnected from each other, it's like terrifying. If I lose, when I see everything interconnected, it gives harmony, it gives peace, it gives integration, I feel safe. Okay, everything is part of a coherent whole. But when everything seems to be in its own orbit, on its own, completely separated, each of us, every single aspect of reality, it's too unsettling, it's too much. So fear comes. That's how the Bhagavatam puts it. And that fear takes us on a journey of taking different stances to avoid the fear, to cope with fear, defense mechanisms. And I will argue, many of our anarthas, as we call them, anarthas, greed, lust, anger, many of us come as a result of this fear we have of perceiving reality separated, divided, and we try to cope with that, and we end up doing a whole series of things that further foster our entanglement. So in one sense, this duality, this separateness, is the source of all problems. So we will say, that's avidya, no? The Bhagavatam says avidya is the root cause of all problems. Avidya means ignorance. And ignorance of what? Ignorance of how everything exists with Krishna in the center. Let's put it that way to begin with. Because we ignore that Krishna is the center, that reality is non-dual, we see things in a dualistic way. And that sets the pace for all the problems as we know them, based on separateness, based on seeing each other as not sharing a common bond. And in our tradition, exactly the very first thing we should learn, the very first layer of education, is what we call in Sanskrit, sambandha. You may have heard that word, sambandha. Sambandha gyan. Sambandha videya prayojan. Right? Prayojan is the ultimate goal, divine love. Avideya is bhakti, the practice of devotional service. Sambandha is the knowledge that educates us to engage in bhakti and to attain the goal of love. And sambandha, the word sambandha, sam means everything. And bandha even sounds like English. It means like bonded. No? So sambandha means everything is bonded. In other words, everything exists in relationship to everything else, because everything shares a common center. So sambandha gyan, gyan means knowledge, means first of all, be educated about how everything exists interconnected, If you have that foundation, which is non-dual foundation, then you are protected from the dangers of dual thinking, of seeing things separate, fragmented. That's how the whole Bhagavad Gita begins. No? The very first verse of the Bhagavad Gita, just the very beginning of the Gita, says the whole problem. Bhagavad Gita is a battlefield, and the battlefield is war and death and conflict, and symbolizes also the constant battlefield we are in on some level. But the first verse, Dharma Kshetri Kuru Kshetri Samabhita Jijutsavaha Mamakas Pandavas Chaiva Kima Kurupata Samjaya. As you know, Dhritarashtra is asking Sanjaya, what did, and he says, Pandavas Mamakas Chaiva. What did my sons and the sons of Pandu did? Now he says Mamaka. Mamaka means like, what did mine, my own? What did my own and the others? Not the us and them mentality. And as we know, the Pandavas were sons of Pandu, who was a brother of Dhritarashtra. And Pandu was dead at the time. So naturally, Dhritarashtra should have adopted the Pandavas as their own, as his own. No, you are also my children, come. But no, he established that separateness. So the first verse of the Gita sets in motion the root of the problem. That was caused the Kurukshetra war. You can take it on a more like a symbolic level. The Bhagavad Gita is showing how this whole all the battlefields, all the wars and conflicts we are going through personally, internally, locally, nationally, internationally, transgalactically, we will reach there, no problem. We'll start our wars with Mars and Saturn and all the other planets. It's coming. It's on its way because we are at war with ourselves. We are divided beings. So we start with us. We have this separateness, this dualism, which creates these boundaries, enemies, us and them. We don't have anything in common, and that creates the war. So Bhagavad Gita is genius in how it presents it. In verse 1, it's showing this is a problem. And what's the solution to the problem? Every chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the name of every chapter of the Gita in Sanskrit ends with the word yoga. Yoga. Sankhya Yoga, Karma Yoga, Jnana Yoga, Bhakti Yoga, Raja Guhya, all yoga. Union, 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 reunion, reconnection, relinking. Why? Because the problem has been separateness, separateness, separateness. So let's bring union. Let's bring union to solve the actual problem. And in one sense, it's not even let's bring union, but let's bring awareness of the union that already is there, right? I'm not even need to tell, okay, let's unite with one another, but let's become aware that we are already part of something in common. And on that basis, we will unite naturally. Let's realize that we are brothers and sisters. Generally, we don't live with that awareness. And of course, we are not willing sometimes to relate to everyone as my brother and sister, because maybe the other person is not aware of that also either. And that person will, if I try to approach as brother and sister, they may attack me, they may abuse me. But if everyone will exist with this idea, we are all members of one family. That's heaven, so to say. That's the spiritual world. And the Vedas say that, no? Again, this famous line, Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam. Vasudhaiva Kutumbakam means there's only one family. Ambija Pradapita, Krishna say, I'm the seed-giving father. Everyone else is the child of God in Christian language, the children of God. So we are all brothers and sisters, ontologically. Biologically, so many families, but ontologically, only one family. When we start to think even about in terms of two families, we start to create separateness. We start to become sectarian. We start to be fundamentalist. We start to create war in one sense. We were talking the other day with a friend, and she was asking me like, so Maharaj, there's war going on in so many places and it's terrible. And of course it is. So what can I do? I feel compelled to, how can I be part of the solution in this? And of course, and this conclusion we reached, at least by the time being, it's an ongoing conversation, but is first of all, I need to ask myself how much I am at war myself with myself, how divided I am, how much I still see things through separateness. Because as long as I realize I'm doing that, I am contributing to war. Even if I'm not officially giving money for this army to buy weapons, I'm still living in separateness. And that's basically what is fostering, what is fueling the fire of conflict in my immediate circle. And when you multiply that bigger and bigger, then you have Ukraine, Russia, Gaza, or whatever, Holocaust, so on and so forth. But it all begins for fragmented beings, fractured beings. So it's important that also we, as sadhakas, we try to work on this, on trying to be as much integrated and as much non-dual as possible in our behavior, in our way of relating to others. Because as we were talking these days, sometimes I can be personalist, but I can be representing my personalistic tradition very impersonally. I can be pretty impersonal in so many ways, how I relate to you, to Krishna, to myself, while my official label is I'm a personalist, I'm a Hare Krishna. So in the same way, we can be, in principle, we are non-dual as a tradition and everything, but we can be in practice very dualistic, very divided, very, I don't know, narrow-mindedness, tribal thinking, fanaticism, separateness, us and them. No, that's not part of our philosophy, ideally. No? So again, dualistic thinking is fragmented. One more point, and with this we go to questions. Dualistic thinking means like fragmented consciousness. I'm perceiving reality in parts, in fragments, fractured consciousness, not like whole, integrated. We are seeing parts instead of holes. Holes with, how do you say, W, not holes with H. No. Dualism creates holes, no? But non-dualism creates, it's pronounced the same, right?
Yes.
I'm trapped. What to do? I need to. Right. So non-dual thinking is placed to see reality as a whole with W, you know, like a complete thing, an integrated thing. And there are holes with WB always within those holes. You know? There's this interesting term that you may like to research more. It's called holarchy. This one starts with H. Now, which is a hierarchy of holes with W, but it started with H, so it's holarchy, which means reality is whole with W, and there are holes within those holes. No? Like you are a complete, like a unit, you are a complete being, but you exist in the context of something bigger than you, which is also complete, and so on and so forth. And I cannot help but immediately go to this verse that you quoted the other day, that you are quoting now, Om Purnama Da Purnami Dam Purnat Purnama Da Chate Purnasya Purnama Daya Purnami Iva Vasishyate. No, it's not that the author has some, how do you say when you repeat the words many times, that you speak like this? It's not a stuttering person, Purnam 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 Purnam. No. That can be a case, yes. But reality is, Purna means complete or perfect or also whole with double B. No? So reality is whole, and within that whole, there's the world is whole, and this is whole, and this is whole. And so that's called sometimes holarchy, no? Like a system of different holes within holes. So that's the vision of non-dual thinking. No? Instead of fractured, fragmented, isolated, separated parts, integrated holes. So that's the message of the Bhagavatam, and that's what Gaudiya Vaishnavism is about. Srimad Bhagavatam, it said that was written by Vyasadeva, or not written, but revealed by Vyasadeva in Samadhi. in trance. No? It is said that he wrote the Bhat and Samadhi Bhasha. No? Bhasha means like language. Like you have Braja Bhasha. No? Bhagavatam was written, sometimes it's, what's the language of Bhagavatam? Sanskrit? No, language of Bhagavatam is Samadhi Bhasha. No, the language of trance. That's how the Bhagavatam came through Vyasadeva. Sometimes it's said, if a book is written in trance, probably you will fully understand it when you enter in trance as well. Right? So in the same way, we could say, if reality is non-dual, okay, but I will fully understand it when I live it as such. When I develop non-dual thinking, I try to live a lifestyle that is more and more based on interconnectedness, integration, instead of separateness and division. So a few thoughts I want to share today on the topic on non-dual thinking and interconnectedness versus separateness. I hope it was not as abstract as I was fearing. It seems not. You survived.
It's more abstract than the way Srila Prabhupada says it. He just says, yeah, yeah. Krishna is the cause of all causes.
Mm-hmm.
Of all causes, yes. All incarnations and devas or whatever. It's clear.
Yeah, we've tried to unpack a little bit that, because sometimes also we can say that, but we need to play out the implications of what it means to say that, what was the meaning of that. But yeah, after unpacking that, we can go back to those one-liners and okay.
It's not criticism.
No. I'm just,
it's clear from the
Yeah. In fact, in the chapter, I quote many other sections that Prabhupada says, and it's very interesting how much he speaks about this topic, but sometimes how much we miss those types of emphasis. No? Because again, our tradition is very diversified and very detailed and specific, and we may get lost in a sea of diversity and lose sight of the underlying unity that connects everything, right? Which is so foundational for the diversity to be, enriching and an ornament and not a cause of conflict. Now, because just to bring it down to our daily relationships, if we have differences, as we all have, because we're individuals, we can have so easily conflict with one another. The only way we won't kill each other, so to say, out of our differences, is to, on top of our difference, to have this, what we have in common, to have that in place. So when that's in place enough, okay, we can talk about our differences. And those differences end up being even ornamentations rather than causes of war, so to say. No? I experience that a lot when I have like interfaith dialogue and conversation with people from other traditions. But before going to the other part of the tradition, I try to find, okay, where we are saying the same thing, believing the same thing, maybe with different words, but where we are on the same page. And on that foundation, we can then go to the diversity. But if the proper foundation of commonality was established first, differences become ornaments eventually. It's like, wow, interesting. I don't think like that, but I appreciate it. Something like that. Right? We do it differently, but beautiful. Because you have this foundation of we are very close to each other in so many other ways. So that's very necessary to build a foundation. Like I want to construct a castle or a temple of divine love in my heart. First come the foundation work. If you want the whole project to be sustainable, the foundation has to be really, really solid. So today we were mostly concentrating on foundation grounding work, so to say. Yeah. So any question, comments, something you may like to share?
You mentioned something kind of like foundation from which we act in this world and play out and, of course, perceive and interact. Mm-hmm. Which is the internal oneness or internal wholeness or non-dualism. Psychologically, how would that look like? in practice of internal dialogue, of perceiving yourself.
Mm-hmm. I can speak for myself, of course, only. Mm-hmm. Each one may find their own best way of relating to that. Because again, I'm throwing these concepts to you, so to say, but each one of you have to, how do I relate to that in a way that works better for me? It may not be the same way that it works better for you. So I'm not here suggesting a universal formula for everyone to swallow, so to say. But as simple as that sounds, I mean, I try, I'm not saying that I'm doing that perfectly, but on a daily basis to remind myself how much what I said basically, no, and it's a daily reminder, internal reminder. We have so much in common. I have more in common with all of you than what I can even see at present. No? I can find something in common, but I like to use this expression as simple as it is, brothers and sisters. I like even to talk to people in those terms, no, like my dear brother, my dear sister. And I mean, I think I haven't philosophical reason to do so, and I'm being correct. No, it's not just brother and sister, like in something emotionally appealing, but just like we are brothers and sisters. We have a common source. So even in something like that, if I tell you, how are you doing, brother? No, it creates something. It's a word that creates like, oh, we are brothers. Well, he's treating me like a brother. Yeah, I'm treating you like a brother because we are brothers. We are all brothers. So immediately starts to create like some particular mood in the relationship. And if you extend that, it creates this. We have some groups in our Sangha with devotees, ladies, Vaishnavis, and groups that we have, and some of them are called brotherhood and sisterhood. No, to emphasize this point, no, like we are brothers, we are sisters, we are all one family. I know many devotees also, they start their meetings like, dear family, how we are doing, like emphasizing these ideas. No, maybe it's a word, but it's triggering, creating something. I'm family. You are my brothers, you are my sisters. And of course, in the mind may come, but they are affiliated in a different institution. Oh, this type of thing. So then my brotherhood and sisterhood is purely institutional? Like, what type of brotherhood is that? No? Or again, biological, or he's my brother and my sister. So then comes all the inner process of confronting my own dogma, my own biases and assumptions. Like when I say brothers, but Maharaj, who is your guru? Maharaj, which is your mission? Maharaj, what's your affiliation? All these like filters and masks that creates one wall after another, one boundary after another. And realizing and witnessing, wow, I have such a defense mechanism that gets triggered and creates like 108 walls in 1 second. And now suddenly me and you are like worlds apart. When in true, we are brothers and sisters. So yeah, it's a daily, how to say, dismantling process, not having to dismantle. And I personally, I think of that personally as a type of sadhana, as a type of anartha nibriti. No, how do I relate to people and force myself to relate to people that are different from me, are from a different mission, are from a different tradition, are from a different mindset, not forcing me to agree on everything, but force in a healthy way, push me to find the commonality, you know? Especially when I, in the immediate, I don't find commonality. Of course, in some cases, I may need to take some healthy distance from some people, but even in that distance, I have to find the commonality. So these are ways that I've tried to put in practice this idea of non-duality, to remind myself on a daily basis, we are all one. I wish I recite some verses from the Bhagavatam also, which are this type of, in other traditions, they call it Shanti mantras, which are these verses that you pray for the well-wishing of of the whole of humanity. And the Bhagavatam has verses like that, no? Swastiastu vishvasya kalo prasidatam dihantu utani shivanmito diya manaschavadram bhajata dadoksaye mano abhishitam nomatirapyahaituki. Now, I wish peace and blessedness to everyone, to every living entity. May there be at peace, there may be peaceful, anyhow. In which I'm not praying to my God, my Vaishnavas, my Guru, my tribe, but everyone is part of the tribe, everyone is part of the family. And even if some people won't accept that, won't behave as that, won't want to relate to me as that, still in principle I know that's the case and I want to feel like that.
Which is the message of Bhagavad Gita as well, the verses there. Brahmana Sisudiko Vision, the elephant, the dog, the Brahmana.
Oh yeah, Vidya Vinaya Sampane Brahman. Yeah, so exactly.
It's all there.
Yeah. Having that equal equipoise, whatever the word we want.
Is my brother. Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
It is there that we should have that vision.
Yeah. At the same time, of course, we have our discernment and criteria, and we may have, doesn't mean that we agree with what everyone is doing. That's a totally different story. But in principle, you are all my family. And even to say that, sometimes I've seen that many times, especially in some circles when you feel that not everyone is feeling like that, seeing like that, and it's like, all of you are my family. And I can see, like, for some, it's like, and they're trying like to process, what do you mean by that? And it's like, this is what I mean, we are all one family. And when we are able to like pierce those veils of separateness, it's really incredible what happens when you really can meet each other on that ground, because that's what's reality actually about. In actuality, we are one family. So when you can have the glimpse of that, oof, it's so relieving, so releasing, so joyful. So I want to say something, Teresa.
It just reminds me of like when there's a war, mm-hmm. there'll be like a national prayer goes out, you know, save America. Mm-hmm. Dear God, please save America. Mm-hmm. Please mm-hmm. save my people or this people.
Yeah.
And it really, the dualism really shows up.
Mm.
Shows up then.
Yeah. And I also remember you told me how in the U.S. when you had the 9/11 thing, and was this, of course, catastrophe, but how that created this sense of unity. I'm not saying we need more 9/11s to create unity, but my point is the phenomenon, how it happened. No? Like we are sure we have a shared catastrophe. Let's put it that way. No, we are all Americans. Our country has been attacked, and we feel all, no?
We were one family,
and you were telling me, you know, how in the streets people will just like put lights on each other's car and greet each other just normally in the street, like showing we are there for each other. Again, I'm not saying, unfortunately, we need some of those things to be reminded of. What if we can live in that way without a 9/11? No, that would be the ideal. But in principle, my point is that's there, and when that's going on, it feels like, wow, we are all one family. Although in that case it was just limited to a country still. But we need to, my point is we need to, I make this, it's tragicomical, but I make this example coming from Argentina, which is a country of soccer, among other things. It's famous for football, soccer. So you have all these teams, and Argentinians get so passionate, you know, about that, and they can kill each other, the fans in the stadium, you know, if you are from the opposite team, and especially between some teams, they really have some separateness. I won't try to preach non-dual thinking into a match. They may kill me first, and they kill him between themselves. But try to get my point. There are two teams and they hate one another sometimes, literally, to the point that they in the fight may kill one another. Still, the two teams are from the same country, Argentina. Then 2 weeks after, Argentina is playing a match. So those same fans from different teams are now part of the same team. And now they're embracing each other, celebrating Argentina's victory. Because why? Because they found like a broader way of identifying each other that allows for a common point of union. Still, it's very limited, my country. But my point is, they went from my team to something bigger, my country. So my following that same principle, we should be able to expand the circle to the point that nobody's left out. And that we are all literally, we are one family. And that fully expanded circle is, we are all connected to Krishna. Let's put it that way. No? Everything, everyone. No? So in that way, we can embrace and integrate and allow all of existence to exist in a way that we can relate from that place and family. Yes.
I have a question in relation to dualism towards Krishna and Paramatma.
Okay.
Often there's a like real life situation for many devotees. Like, how is it that because Paramatma, he's a sanctioner, he's an observer, he's a witness, he's more or less neutral. But then, yeah, at least myself, I tend to then perceive Krishna as completely different person from Paramatma, because with Krishna, then I wonder, where is Krishna in my life? Okay, Paramatma is there, but it's different. And then can Krishna communicate through Paramatma? It's always during your class, I really figured out that, yeah, we have, it's a dualistic approach. Like, I created politics of Paramatma, Krishna, and you can...
Sorry to throw...
Pray, who will hear me?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. And sorry to have thrown you to an existential crisis now, Anupam. That question, that very question, who to pray or who is hearing my prayers, that's presented by Bhishmana Chakravarti Thakur at the end of his Raghavartma Chandrika. He's asking, and this is a long conversation, I just mentioned a few things. One, I will say that when we say Paramatma, before going to that point, we say Paramatma is neutral. I wouldn't say that much of a neutral person, because sometimes we have this idea of like an insensitive, indifferent witness. And we read all over the scripture, Krishna saying, I'm the well-wishing friend of all living entities. I'm in everyone's heart. Paramatma is called as Chaitya Guru, right? And a guru is not supposed to be indifferent, right? Why it's called guru, no? No, if a guru is just like, no, a guru is supposed to be someone who is a well-wishing friend of the soul, no? And there are many verses in the scripture, and I quote them in Radical Personalism book, how Bhagavan or God, let's put it, even in the feature of Paramatma, is not indifferent, no? But has a good heart, good intention for us. But I will say in that verse, one argument will be, because someone will say, Krishna, according to how you surrender to me, I reciprocate. And one will say, okay, if you hate Krishna, then Krishna hates you. That's not applicable. Because the verse says, Yeyatamam prapadyante. Prapadyante means to surrender. So in that verse, Krishna is exclusively talking about those who approach him and how he reciprocates with his devotees, basically. But the separate department is how God deals with those who do not approach him. No? And for that, you have all these verses where Krishna says, Suhridam sarvabhutanam. For example, I'm the well-wishing friend of all living entities, which for me doesn't sound like indifferent. Right? But again, it's a big conversation, just touching upon that. But going to your question, who hears my prayers? Paramatma, where is Krishna? Is there some two people, one people? Anyhow, so Bhishmana Chakravarti Thakur makes that same question at the end of Raghavartma Chandrika, second part of the book. Like, I'm a devotee, he says, I'm a Gaudiya Vaishnav, and my Ishtadev is Krishna. So he makes another point, but I will go to your point. I'm praying to Krishna. He's my deity. My deity is not Paramatma. Although they're the same person, but my deity of choice is not Paramatma, it's not Vishnu, it's not whatever. Barahadev, with all respect to each of them, my deity is Krishna. So when I'm praying, who is hearing me? And he himself say, well, someone may tell you, Paramatma is hearing your prayers. And he says, but a Gaudiya Vaishnava won't be satisfied with that. Because they want a relationship with Krishna. They understand Paramatma is an aspect of Krishna, but they want the connection with Krishna. So the point in conclusion is, and this is an interesting point, that is, in a devotee, of course, there are degrees of devotees, but Paramatma has more to do with the jivas who are not participating in bhakti. That's the point that Jiva Goswami makes in his Paramatma Sandarbha. He says Paramatma is in charge of Jiva Shakti and Maya Shakti, of material world and the souls under the influence of the material world. Paramatma is presiding over that department. When we are speaking about jivas connected to bhakti, Bhagavan is presiding over that. In other words, you don't have Paramatma. You have Krishna in your heart. That's how our acharyas will explain it. In your heart, Paramatma has been replaced by Krishna, because Krishna is your deity. Famous example that I always give, Hanuman. Famous painting of Hanuman opening his chest. Who appears there? Paramatma? There is no Paramatma there. Paramatma was kicked out. Sita Ram is there. His Ishtadev, his deity of choice. There is no Paramatma. Paramatma has, if you will, blossomed into Bhagavan and Bhagavati, to the god and the goddess. So that's how we should understand it. As bhaktas, in my heart, there is Bhagavan. There is my whatever form of Bhagavan I worship, whether it is Krishna in certain mood, whether it's Mahaprabhu. Again, they are the same person, but they are taking a particular shape. So Paramatma has more to do with those who are not engaged in bhakti. So Paramatma is in every heart, in every atom even, but in the heart of a devotee, there is Bhagavan. Again, not making a whole difference between Bhagavan and Paramatma, but still there is some difference, and what makes that difference is bhakti. So when you practice bhakti, we don't hear bhakti toward Paramatma. No. We hear bhakti towards forms of Bhagavan. Bhagavan is the corresponding aspect of God that relates to bhakti. Paramatma is more like the well-wishing witness, whatever you may like to call it, that is accompanying the soul as long as the soul is not connected consciously to God under the influence of Maya Shakti. That's the whole Paramatma Sandarbha of Jiva Goswami. That's the whole treatise explaining Paramatma in connection to Jivas in Maya Shakti. And then it comes Bhagavat Sandarbha, talking about Bhagavan, and how Bhagavan is in the heart of the devotee, not Paramatma. So if this may be new, hopefully it's good news. So you know, we don't need to think, okay, so here is Paramatma, and Bhagavan is over there above the sky, whatever, how we imagine. And it goes through the agency and eventually reaches the prayer and the email to Bhagavan, and then reciprocates, and Paramatma says, no, no, Bhagavan, Krishna is already in your heart. No? That he says in the Bhagavatam, no? Sadhavo hridayam mahyam sadhunam hridayam. I'm in the heart of my sadhus. That's not Paramatma speaking, it's Bhagavan. I'm in the heart, I'm the heart of my sadhus, and they are my heart. I'm in their heart, they are in my heart. I don't know anyone apart from them, they don't know anyone apart from me. That's Bhagavan speaking. So there are many evidence in Shastra of Bhagavan saying, I am the heart. Krishna himself in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is saying that also. Is that clear?
Yeah.
May need some time for further processing, but yeah, that's basically the idea.
One question, actually.
Okay, we will go. We'll have to.
If somebody else first wants,
she raised her hand before you actually.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
So go on.
Please,
yes.
Connected to Anupama's question.
Okay, yeah, then let's go there.
You were speaking about the unity of
even the deities.
Yeah.
So in Bangladesh, we have three different altars, basically. And I have to admit, this is my personal struggle. I feel very overwhelmed in my practice, because even at home, we have so many deities, and mm-hmm. our children have their deities. And, you know, so, and then, of course, we're chanting the holy name, and Harinam is a deity as well. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I'm really so overwhelmed, and I'm thinking, like, too much.
Yeah.
Too much Krishna. And I know that there's different aspects of Krishna, and I guess that we can relate to different qualities of Krishna, but still,
yeah.
maybe there's something you could help me
with
my
okay.
overwhelm.
Mm. Yeah, I saw your face when I was mentioning about the three altars and all things. Like, yeah, not to blame the three altars, of course. but yeah, of course. And I've seen sometimes, in apart from official altars, sometimes in altars in temples or houses of devotees, like the more deities, the better. No, and it's kind of like an overpopulation of Bhagavans on the, and I'm not condemning that, but I also question myself, like, okay, what's the focus of the person when addressing the altar? What's the connection, the relationship? Because if you have, like, in the same altar everything and everyone, although they are the same person in one sense. Which capacity do we have to process all that diversity in a way that remains non-dual? If you have that capacity, I have no problem, that's fine. But if we realize, actually I'm being polytheistic, then we need to do something about it. No? And I'm not telling people what to do. Of course, I personally am more of the more minimalistic approach, so there can be more, like, clear, simple focus in one particular direction. But I will say that one has to also find one's own affinity, so to say, no? Like, okay, you may have different three altars here, but maybe you have your favorite altar of the three, to give an example. And even in that one altar, there may be one particular expression of the divine that you can relate more to, let's say Nityananda Prabhu, let's say whomever, no? Shirada, and so on. So also one has to eventually, maybe in the beginning it starts like very overpopulated, even in one's own mind, but eventually it will become ideally more specific, no? More like directed. And so there is place for me to ask, okay, how do I feel more focused and connected and absorbed? What facilitates more my presence? How can I relate to God in a way that I really feel not overwhelmed, but I can feel even peaceful, so to say. And sometimes I may not need to think too much, you know, because when we get stuck in the thinking platform and try to accommodate all these forms in our head, it may just get worse sometimes. So sometimes we may just understand, okay, all those forms are the same person, and address that same person, even without forcing me to have, even like, okay, this or this, whom, like, understand they are the same person, the same Supreme Personality, and I want to be present to that relationship and open to how that person wants to approach me as well. But yeah, it's good that one is becomes aware of that as well, no? And one can try to make some conscious adjustment that may work. Not rejecting the diversity, but sometimes, again, it's healthy, at least for me. And I've been talking with some other devotees. I remember talking, I think, with Joy Jagannath or someone else, and we were talking like, yeah, for some devotees, they may think that we are becoming impersonal or something, he was telling, because we are more emphasizing this non-dual aspect and the need for more foundation of this, like, all is one in the sense we have been talking about, instead of going to the super diversified details of our tradition that sometimes can be overwhelming or can create, again, separateness if we don't have enough foundation. So if we feel that need, we may need to concentrate our studies or our prayer or our focus in chanting in there's one non-dual, the ultimate reality, non-separated, whole, no, not like going to all this an endless pantheon in my own mind that I became like overwhelmed and paralyzed. So yeah, we have to see what trial and error, so to say, what works better for each of us in every chapter. Because also, yes, just forcing ourselves to, you know, I will sit in front of an altar with 34 deities and I will try to absorb and integrate everything and realize the non-dual nature of them. And I may not have that capacity yet. No, and it's okay. No, I shouldn't feel bad about it. But we can also go to that place. Oh, maybe I'm being offensive. There's some problem with me that I'm overwhelmed by this, and no need to go there. Yeah. Teresa?
Just a quick thing. It kind of reminds me of Bhaktivinoda Thakur when he was speaking about when he went to the other church and he was praying. And because he had that non-dual foundation, that he was able to accommodate even another tradition's way of worship and see his own Lord in that totally, completely different form. And in that,
I will read it
here. About capacity, so he has the capacity to do that, even though he remained true to his own Ishtadev. Mm-hmm. Let's see the oneness.
So the quote Bhakti Rasa is referring to, and maybe we can conclude here, since I know you have to do something at 8.
No, I can't leave. You can stay.
It
doesn't matter.
No. We want to properly honor. This is a quote. I like to mention this quote, which is very beautiful. And it was funny because this quote is one of my favorite quotes from Bhaktivinoda Thakur. And I quote it here. And the other day when we were having our podcast with Krishna Kshetra Maharaj, we were talking about something. And he was like, while talking to me, was like looking for some reference. I said, oh, this is a quote I want to share. There is something about Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, and he starts reading this quote. He's reading the whole quote, and I'm like, yes. So this is a quote. If one goes to someone else's place of worship, so he's speaking about someone other traditions, not even in our. If one goes to someone else's place of worship, one should think, these people are worshiping my Lord, but in a different way. Because of my different training, I cannot quite comprehend this system of worship. However, through this experience, I can deepen my appreciation for my own system of worship. The Lord is only one, not two. I offer respects to the form I see here and pray to the Lord in this new form that He increases my love for the Lord His accustomed form. Those who do not follow this procedure, but instead criticize other systems of worship and show hatred, violence, and envy, are worthless and foolish. The more they indulge in useless quarreling, the more they betray the very goal of their religion. So yeah.
Another good example is Bhishma Deva, Mahajan, who speaks to all the assembly from different Mahajan.
So, actually that section is part of the chapter non-dual thinking, because in that chapter I talk about what we talked today, but on that basis and go to appreciating other traditions and learning from other traditions on the basis of non-dual foundation, right? So anyhow, I don't want to overextend. Maybe we can put the discussion to rest for today and process what we shared. And tomorrow we can gather again if there are further questions and comments. But it's almost 8, so everyone can do what they have to do, go to rest, relax, process, whatever needs to be done. And tomorrow we will have today. Tomorrow is Saturday?
Yeah.
Saturday?
Yeah.
Okay, so we'll have one penultimate meeting, and I was thinking on Sunday probably we can just entertain questions on whatever topic. No? These days we have been speaking on certain topics, but on Sunday we can just open for whatever topic theme we would like to hear or share. So that's also welcome. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, Sri Sri Krishna Balaram Ki Jai, Sadhu Sangha Ki Jai, Gaur Premananda Hari Hari Vancha Kalpataru Yascha Sindhu.